Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This is the time that I want to say good morning to Dr. Carl, because I'm going to bring him in to this conversation. Dr. Carl, good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thank you, Dr. Howard. And hello, Dr. Carroll.
Right. So here's the thing. Is Business Insider reporting yesterday that one of our major production companies, factories that produce potato chips, are now getting rid of the tomato flavor. And people are quite upset by it because it was one of those iconic flavors. And it would seem as though our tastes seem to change. So whereas people always loved salt and vinegar or plain salted or whatever it would be, now they're going for onion and something or other. Do our tastes change during our age, and do they change from, let's say, one generation to another?
Yes, there are cultural changes and there are biological changes. So cultural changes would be that if you were, for example, brought up in India, mm-hmm. and your mother ate a lot of curries while she was pregnant with you in her belly, you would have a strong preference for curries as a result of various of those molecules making their way across the placenta to you and tilting your preference.
Right.
So secondly, from that's a biological thing that's inside you. Then secondly, when you grow up in a society, you will grow up enjoying those foods. So apparently, people coming to Australia cannot understand Vegemite, which is basically a black paste, incredibly highly salted, made up of the dead bodies of yeast. And because we've been brought up with it, we like it. And other people can't understand why we would eat such a repulsive thing. But then thirdly, there's a change in biology within the living creature. So it turns out that when you are younger and pre-pubertal, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, mm-hmm. you have a strong aversion or dislike to the taste of bitter. And that makes sense because you haven't hit puberty, you haven't had your babies, and there are many foods in the world that are bitter and poisonous. In many cases, bitter and poisonous are associated. But then as you get older, your bitterness goes away, your sense of bitterness, and it turns out that some of the foods that are bitter also have anti-cancer properties, very weak ones. So, for example, broccoli has a chemical in it called sinigrin, S-I-N-E-G-R-I-N, which has weak anti-cancer properties. And so that way, if you eat more broccoli when you're older, you'll have a slight reduction in cancers as you get older.
So it's both cultural and age-related.
And biological as well. So if you were born in India and in your mother and family then migrated to a country where they didn't have curries, you'd still have a secret hankering for it from your early days in the uterus.
That is so interesting, because one of the examples I gave earlier is that many people for example, the Jewish community, the grandparents might have come from Eastern Europe, where they would have liked herrings and that type of food. Our parents' generation still enjoyed it, but the third generation, most of us don't really enjoy that type of food. So following the logic, it's exactly what you're saying.
Yes, and of course, then there's marketing. And so the marketing will tell you that if you like salt and vinegar, you are so 20th century, and you've really got to get salt and vinegar and broccoli to be really cool, man.
Or worse, kale chips. We want to eat kale chips. Do you know how cool we are if we eat kale chips?
Well, my daughter actually cooked some up for me, and they weren't that bad.
Really?
Bearing in mind that I was basically appreciating the salt.
that's exactly right. And Ronnie says, ghost pops can seriously go on retirement. We've suffered enough indeed. All right. So thank you for that answer. Let's look at some of the other questions. Let's, once we're on this, the ingestion track, let's talk about vitamins. Are they good for us, or are they just a waste of time and money?
If you get them out of food, they are good for you. But if, like half of the people in Australia, at least 47%, you get them from a bottle, they are firstly a waste, and secondly, they can interact when you have too much. And you're thinking, how can you have too much vitamins? Surely they're safe. Well, that goes back to the 1970s. And in America, the Vietnam War was going on, but also there was a senator called William Proxmire, who was also a lobbyist for the vitamin companies. And the American FDA, the Food and Drug Administration of the time, had quite strict regulations on vitamins, and he was an anti-science person. Every week he would give an award of the Golden Fleece of the Week for people doing stupid research, like into vaccines against polio and other wasteful research that didn't directly make him wealthier on the day. And so he, working for his masters in the food industry, in the vitamin industry, brought it in that there would be no limit on how much you could have in vitamins. So you can go into a chemist and buy anything you want. And if you have too much, say, vitamin C, you can set yourself up for having kidney stones. And the real problem is that when you have a bunch of vitamins, you're getting the same vitamins in pack number 1 and 2 and 3. And you don't realize it because you're not realizing how much vitamin C you're getting in each of those. And so you can end up getting overdoses. So really, the best way to get your vitamins is from food. Eat food, comma, mostly plants, comma, not too much. That's the rule of, what is his name? He wrote a book called In Defense of Food. I forget his name. Mm-hmm. The book is called In Defense of Food, and that's the motto. Eat food, comma, mostly plants, not too much.
Let's talk about the Sloan Sky Survey Telescope. What is that?
It's a telescope that's been running for about 20 years, and it's just been staring at various bits of the sky, and it has discovered hundreds of millions of new of stars and galaxies and where they are. And overall, it looked at 2 billion galaxies over about a 20-year period, and they found very, very ancient structures about 1,000 light-years across, like a hollow ball. And at the center was this dense clump of dark matter, and on the outside was just regular matter, and in between was mostly empty space. And you're thinking, okay, so how does this make my life better? Well, Albert Einstein and his research gave us the ability, when you're slightly inebriated on a Saturday night, to navigate your way to a pizza bar to get your healthy filling of saturated fats. In other words, he accidentally invented GPS. So who knows what this will give to us? So this is another discovery from the land of astronomy, which in 10, 20, 30, 40 years will flow on and make our lives better in ways that we have no idea of today.
It's so interesting that, because we are doing a lot of that, aren't we? We're collecting data. And it's not just in space, it's all over the show. We're collecting data, but we just haven't quite figured out all the uses yet.
That's right. I tend to think of it as being a five-stage process, and the reason I've classified it into five is that I can remember five things, but I can't remember six. I've got a terrible memory. So the first stage is data. And when you get enough data, you can turn that into information. And when you get enough information, looking at it with your brain, you can turn that into knowledge. And then, if you keep working on it, you can turn it into wisdom, and then finally, enlightenment. And so there's so much data we're gathering in, and yet we are so far away from wisdom and enlightenment and how to use that knowledge.
Go through those again, because some of us can't even remember.
So, okay, so data is first. Mm-hmm. Followed by information.
Ah, okay.
That's sort of like a bit of a category of data.
That's data.
And then the next stage up is
knowledge. Right.
So you've managed to turn into knowledge. And then once you've got a bit of knowledge, then you can, with that knowledge, do something and have a bit of wisdom, and then start, say, for example, working out how to build a new machine. And then finally have the enlightenment to realize that the human race is not ready for this machine and not develop it. Or use it in ways for humanity's good rather than for humanity's evil. So, for example, fire is a good tool but a bad master. So you've got to have both wisdom and enlightenment to be able to deal with the hard data so that overall humanity is made better.
Tell us about the Russian Nauka. Is it called the Russian Nauka?
That's right. It's a space module, and Have you heard of the concept of a Friday car? Car that's made on Friday in a factory and everything is wrong with it and it's a lemon and it'll always be bad no matter what happens?
Mm-hmm. We've got a power station like that. We call it Medupi.
What do you call it?
Well, it's Medupi. It's one of our major power stations. It's a 3-year project that's taken 14 years and hardly produces any electricity.
Right. So it was made on a Friday in concept. And if they were supposed to use a brass washer, they used a rusty iron one. And if they were supposed to use a nylon bracket, they used one made out of cardboard. So the Nauka was postulated way back in the 90s. And it eventually got going around 2013 where they built it, but then the propulsion system started leaking on this module, this 23-ton module that was supposed to go up to the International Space Station immediately. And then they had to put in a new propulsion system. And then a little bit later in 2017, the propellant tanks were found to be contaminated with metal dust. And then by the time you get up to 2018, it had been delayed for so long that the warranty on the rocket engines ran out. And they had to put in new rocket engines. And then valves had to be replaced on the fuel tanks because they had worn out. And then they managed to get it onto the space rocket. And it took a long time because there were a whole lot of problems. And then on the launch, some of the rocket engines didn't fire properly. And so it didn't get all the way into orbit. So they tried to make it fire. And they couldn't quite make it fire properly. And then eventually they managed to force the rocket to fire and got it heading towards the International Space Station last week. And it was supposed to come in, this 23-ton thing, you know, big thing, and autonomously, and then the autonomous thing failed, so they had to run it in manually, and they managed to get it in, and then it gets bad. Then it gets really bad. 3 hours after it had docked with the International Space Station, its rockets started firing by themselves, and it tipped the International Space Station, all 400 tons of this structure, 100 meters by 70 meters by 20 meters, it tipped it through a complete circle 1.5 times upside down. And they lost communication with the ground, and they also were unable to get energy because the solar panels were pointing at the sun. And the only reason, the way they could stop it, was that the thing ran out of fuel. And then they had to fire up some other engines on other rockets to try and get it straight again. And they got it straight. And in 2025, this thing is supposed to be taken off the International Space Station and put onto the Russian or the Russian-Chinese Space Station. We're not sure which. I'm kind of now, I'm a person of science, Dr. Howard, but a bit of me believes in suspicion, and I think this thing might be a lemon. Keep an eye on it and just see if it causes any other problems in the future.
Absolutely right. That's where we leave it, Dr. Cole. Wonderful, as always, to chat to you. It has just gone 7:30. A very good morning.